Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What's made the difference from the beginning of Andrew Cuomo's daily briefings on the coronavirus has been his relatively calm and competent air with the vast landscape of hospitals, beds, masks, the needs of New York. And then there's been something extra, the human touch. Cuomo had a classic comeback when a politician in Texas said old folks might be willing to die offstage to save the economy.
Yeah, my mother is not expendable. And your mother is not expendable. And our brothers and sisters are not expendable. And we're not going to accept a premise that human life is disposable. And we're not going to put a dollar figure on human life.
Donald Trump in the White House and Andrew Cuomo in Albany might as well be coming at us from two different countries. Trump's is a land of cutthroat divisions over science, authority, privilege. Cuomo's is an extended family where differences will always have to be resolved.
I just want to make sure everyone feels included, right? It's Columbus Day, and big part for the Italian-American community is about family. And New York is a family.
Cuomo's advantage is that we would rather live in his sort of world, and most of us always thought we did. It's the mark of humanity, not policy, that has made Andrew Cuomo the un-Trump in this crisis. It's made a lot of people wish Cuomo were the alternative choice in November. Michael Greenberg is a literary essayist and lifetime New Yorker who felt moved to set down just how the rough-and-tumble, almost discredited second-generation governor of New York had transformed himself in the crisis into the indispensable figure, the emergency responder.
Well, as a New Yorker, and many of us in New York, we couldn't be more astonished at this performance and the way he has risen to the occasion of this crisis, of which New York is the epicenter, has been the epicenter, and I hope that it proves to be the epicenter. It doesn't go much further into these kinds of numbers. But to me, the reason that Cuomo has performed so well is that for all his rough and tumble politics, for all his kind of tough guy control, he really loves power. He has never shown any particular love for money. He's never made money before going into office. He's never left office. He's been a public servant. And I think it's that sense of him as a public servant that he has, that America has responded to, and that he has responded to. I remember at one point during one of his briefings, he said, you know, 85% of government is petty. It's garbage. You're fighting with people over things that don't matter for anybody. He said, but this is the purest form of public service. And you really felt that he meant it. And then there was the intimate quality of his conversation with the state and then beyond the state to the nation as more people began to tune in. That also was very unexpected. One never saw this from Cuomo before, and it wasn't maudlin. It wasn't self-pitying. He wasn't blaming anyone. He was measured, and he was talking to people's fears. See, he was presenting himself as another New Yorker, isolated with his daughters, worried about his mother, understanding the isolation and the climbing of the walls and the cabin fever that people were feeling. He at one point he called social isolation or social distancing repugnant.
Yeah.
Social distancing, don't go near anyone. What a terrible thing to live with as a human being. What a cruel torture. Just think how emotionally and personally repugnant that concept is, right? We crave human connection. And now we're being told that could be dangerous. You can't kiss, you can't hug, you can't hold hands.
So he was really touching on the very deep feelings that his constituents were experiencing. He was right there.
You can't not be reminded of Rudy Giuliani at 9/11, but What makes a leader in a crisis that may not have been that figure before or since?
You know, 9/11 was a patriotic moment. It was easy to posture. This is something very different. Cuomo would call this a war, and he would, you know, sometimes he was absurd and hokey and would pretend to be this kind of field commander. But essentially, because it's not a war, I mean, only one side is armed, the virus, and the only way to fight it is to sort of retreat and hide. But he managed to show an understanding, first of all, of government.
Yes.
A managerial expertise that we rarely see nowadays. And I think this is what the country was really responding to, is this competence, this understanding of the hospital system, of how stretched it was, of what the healthcare workers were going to, of marshaling. He was like a quartermaster, if we're to extend the war metaphor, in the sense that he was gathering war material, ventilators, masks, beds. He was strong-arming hospital administrators. He was gathering volunteers.
What am I going to do with 400 ventilators when I need 30,000? You pick the 26,000 people who are going to die because you only sent 400 ventilators.
He was working on this in this frenetic pace.
Yep.
And in a way, you know, we're watching this every day at around noon. And we're extremely involved because our lives might depend on it.
Michael, there's a range of masteries here. You mentioned the quartermaster. I'm looking at the global purchasing agent. He knows where the masks are made. He's dickering over prices with China, with suppliers. But then there's the whole acting range, too. Doing his father, maybe better than his father did, talking about the family of New York, talking about, I mean, he certainly stepped into the role of team captain here. And there's nobody quite like him. Perfect foil for Donald Trump, but the model governor, the model competent American pragmatic problem solver.
Yes, the pragmatist, the non-ideologue. I mean, you could argue whether he's an ideologue or not. And there are a lot of people who have been unhappy with Cuomo in New York. You know, there are certain policies that I myself have strongly disagreed with. But his understanding of pragmatic government, of how to work Trump, for instance,
yes,
at a time when New Yorkers were sort of wretchedly dependent on his good graces, on Trump's good graces. Cuomo understood this. Once he got everything he knew he could out of the government, he was very, very nuanced and very granular in understanding how much he could get and when he had reached his limit. And that was when he got 3,000 hospital beds that would be staffed and equipped by the federal government, which was relieving the state hospital system quite a bit. And he got 4,400 ventilators out of the rather meager, it turned out, national stockpile. Once he got that, he took the gloves off a little bit and started going after Trump in a more direct way, because he was trying to defend the governor's position. I mean, this is now turned into a states' rights, federal rights.
First of all, if he's sitting home watching TV, maybe he should get up and go to work, right? He wants to say, well, I did enough. Yeah, none of us have done enough. We haven't, because it's not over. So yes, thank you for the Javits. Thank you for the U.S. Navy ship Comfort. But it's not over. We have a lot more to do. And no one can take the posture, well, just say thank you for what I've done, and I'm now out. I'm not doing anything else. I've done my part. He's doing nothing.
He wasn't grandstanding. He was getting what he could for the states. There was always a sense that he was protecting us. At times, he was a little bit of a prisoner of Trump, and he shared that feeling with us. We were all kind of prisoners of Trump, but let's see what favors we can get to make our imprisonment less severe at this moment. There was just a sense of being in extremely capable hands, and I think Americans are so starved for this. I mean, in the end, it's just good government, right? Admirable as his behavior was, it was just good government in a moment of crisis, in a moment of emergency. You muster your forces, you protect the population. But the idea that he was doing this as a civil servant, as a public servant, rather than in any other way, you know, he had the great advantage of not running for office. And he kept repeating that. Whether he ends up being drafted or not by some fluke, who knows? I would tend to doubt it, but you never know what's going to happen in this wild political season.
No, but we've got to figure out what to do with this phenomenon, this epiphany of the leader we needed. And as you say, you know, you referred to him as New York's unloved governor. He's known as a control freak in a very corrupt state capital in which there's been all sorts of indictment, people being thrown out, let out, voted out. But there was something, some mastery, some subtlety, some humanity that we didn't appreciate.
Well, I mean, if we look back at his formation, at his family, this tough, severe Italian Queens family, it's interesting because Queens has produced three political figures in the very recent past and in present days. Giuliani,
yep.
Trump, and Cuomo. Right. We're very pleased for Queens to have come up with Cuomo finally after Giuliani and Trump. But I think there is a cultural formation there. You know, his father was basically a local activist.
Yep. Community organizer and leader.
Exactly. A community organizer. I mean, he was a writer and he was a governor of New York who also was talked about for president, but backed out. And, you know, Andrew, his son, was rebellious. He shows up sometimes at events in like a 1970s GTO muscle car, and he's a weekend motorcyclist. You wouldn't be surprised to see him hanging out in front of some diner with his motorcycle pals. But somehow he channeled that experience, that pedigree, all the things that made him seem unacceptable in the progressive wave of Ocasio-Cortez and all the things that I myself found not liking about him, the fact that he came into politics through the front door, the fact that he had this pedigree, that he was privileged politically, that he blocked certain things, certain progressive laws from ever happening in Albany using his leverage. But those things have fallen by the wayside. And we see the rise of a pragmatist centrist with a soul and a heart.
More Michael Greenberg in a moment, the New Yorker who writes about writing. Coming up, the craving Andrew Cuomo induces for spaghetti and meatballs over the family table. This is Open Source. It's been a while in America since a leader had as much to say as Andrew Cuomo does about the family he grew up in and the family he raised. It all gets into his narrative of COVID-19 in New York, and Michael Greenberg, our guest, can't get enough of it.
I get this beautiful silver lining in the midst of this hell where my daughters are with me again. And we get to celebrate family, and we get to bring back traditions, and we get to enjoy each other and have really in-depth conversations that we even haven't had in years, right? And reconnect in a way we haven't had the opportunity in years. Today is Sunday, and I come from an Italian-American household where we had a great tradition on Sundays. The family had to come together at the table. You had to be there. They called it dinner, but it started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It was somewhere in the, I don't really know why they called it dinner, but everybody was at the table. Spaghetti and meatballs every Sunday. I started my tomato sauce before I left. We're going to go back. We're going to sit at the table, have our spaghetti and meatballs on Sunday.
And then he went into this incredible aside about, yeah, and the boyfriend's coming.
Advice to fathers, you can never say you don't like the boyfriend. I learned this lesson the hard way.
What did that have to do with anything except his confidence, a certain humanity, a kind of manliness, a deep affection that he couldn't resist? We don't have that in our lives anymore. It was so beautiful.
Yes, he somehow started free associating and rambling about personal life. And I think he knew that this mattered to people and that they would listen to this. Whenever he got into these kind of reflective riffs, he was in the place where every body in isolation was at, thinking about our parents, thinking about our children, thinking about ourselves, thinking about death, on this surreal pause from our lives, worried about our livelihoods, worried about our future, even worried about going out to get food. And he somehow was touching this. And this was unexpected. This was really powerful. And I think you're right. I think this is perhaps more than the managerial husbanding of material for the hospitals, which was all very admirable and extremely important. And it also went against type. Here's this tough guy, right?
Yes.
But yet it never felt and doesn't feel, you know, manufactured in any way. It feels like a person talking about, yes, yeah, you know, I'm going to pretend to like the boyfriend.
I'm interested that the background in this case is Albany and the ghost of Franklin Roosevelt. What does that have to do, not with our fascination with Cuomo, but Cuomo's understanding of himself? This is leadership. He's in the place where the definitive modern critical leadership came from.
Yes, absolutely. It's very interesting because he used Roosevelt in a very poignant way when there was the possibility of a ventilator crisis.
Yes.
And he was being accused of hoarding ventilators because he was waiting for the apex and he was getting as many ventilators as he could. And he started talking about sharing them. And he used a quote, a really phenomenal speech by Roosevelt when he was attacked for supporting the European allies against the Nazis and the Axis. The FDR story was, if your house is burning down and I lend you my hose and I'm your next door neighbor. He was doing it in this way that Americans could understand. My hose gets ruined, but it saves your house. You know, and I know you'll buy me a new hose, probably, or, you know, and he was talking about it in this way. So he was feeling Roosevelt. He was in that executive chamber, actually, in Albany, where Roosevelt presided and where his father presided. And yeah, I do think that he was infected with that and influenced by that. You know, it's hard to know how long a political rise like this will last.
Right.
What legs does this have? How deeply has he captured the country? Or has he simply acted as an instructor on what the country needs, whether it be him or someone else? But maybe breaking the spell of sort of venom and degradation and incompetence that has been cast over America with Trump. I think perhaps he might have broken that spell, not only him, but some of the other governors, too. And I'm hoping, because let's face it, it's quote unquote deep state technocrats and experienced politicians like Cuomo that have led us out of this. And I don't think that's lost on America.
I think you're right, Michael. He speaks to a different country. When I watch Cuomo after watching Trump, I think, they're speaking to two different countries, and I like Cuomo's country so much better. I want to live there.
Yes, exactly. And I think there are a lot of Americans that feel that. Cuomo's country is bigger than Trump's country.
Thank you.
Essentially.
In a crisis of sadness, fear, incredible anxiety, we've seen a man for the assignment, for the occasion. And it's a huge gift. What sort of transformation can you suppose is going on inside that man?
I think this has changed him quite profoundly. And I think those reflective moments that you were referring to before and that we were talking about before, when he talks about his family and he talks about isolation and he even talks about his dog and how he's getting annoyed with his dog being in isolation with him. His dog's lost the sense of who's at the top of the pack. I mean, he goes everywhere. His relationship with his brother, his worry about his brother when his brother got struck by the virus, his younger brother.
Right.
I think that he has really had a transformation, a kind of epiphany. I think this has changed him very profoundly. You know, he's being watched very much in France and Europe, apparently.
Tell me.
And the French sent a correspondent into his briefings, and the correspondent asked him exactly this question. And Andrew Cuomo, the macho, said, "Oh, I don't change anymore. Ask my daughters. I never change." Hmm. But he is talking about things that he never talked about before. He's really trying to take on board the plight of the healthcare workers, the fact that more than twice the number of victims in New York are Black and Hispanic.
Yep.
And why this is, he always points out it's not just comorbidity, it's not just poverty, it's because the majority of people on the front lines in these underpaid healthcare jobs
right.
are Black and Latino.
And doing the essential jobs.
Yeah, and he's really moved by this in a way that you never felt from him before. It reminds me a little slightly of RFK, Robert Fitzgerald Kennedy, whose yep. daughter he was married to, when he came back into politics and ran for Senate in New York and then ran for president, where he had this kind of explosive sense of the left behind America. It really was a transformation in him. I feel that something along that line has happened with Cuomo. And I think it's real because he really took on what was going on in New York. He took it on. He said, the buck stops here. He went absolutely into action in a way that was impressive. And, you know, a lot of other governors sort of did, but you didn't feel it the way you did from Cuomo.
No.
I mean, you know, Jay Inslee in Washington did a great job, actually.
Yes.
But he ended up fighting with Trump at the wrong moment. And I think now is the time to really take down Trump for Cuomo. And I think he might.
We don't know where it leads, Michael Greenberg, but we savor this moment.
Yeah, we do.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chris.
Michael Greenberg's new piece in the New York Review of Books is called Emergency Responder. The journalist and biographer George Packer is just out with an account that Donald Trump will not be writing. In The Atlantic Online, George Packer notes, "We have been waking every morning since the start of March to find ourselves citizens of a failed state, like Pakistan or maybe Belarus, with shoddy infrastructure and a dysfunctional government, too corrupt or stupid to save lives of its own sick people."
Well, some people saw the threat of a pandemic coming. They were the experts. They were the NIH people and the planners and modelers. And no one listened to them, or very few people, because they generally don't get listened to. We tend to ignore things that aren't right in front of our face. The bigger failure, the failure of our national government and the failure of our, really of our society, to be able to handle something on this scale is a harder one to answer. I think there are two or three forces at work, and they've been going on for a long time, some throughout the Trump years, but some much, much longer, including really the most important, which has been going on since I was a college student, which was an assault on government that has been the dominant noise in the political sphere since 1980 when Ronald Reagan was elected. And that has been going on for a long time. And lately has become so nihilistic, so that it's gone from we want government to be small to we want government to be incapable. And we want it to be stupid and we want it to be corrupt. That when something as dire as the pandemic arrives, it shouldn't be a surprise to find out that you needed those institutions because nothing else can handle it except on a national scale. And if you have been assaulting them and defunding them and demoralizing them for years and years, imagining you will never pay a price, then you've been naive. But you never really know how bad it is. For me, as an American, it's hard to anticipate how low it can get, how bad it can be. Because when I was growing up, for all our follies and our sins, you still felt basically that adults were in charge and that they knew how to do things. During the month of March, I suddenly felt no one is in charge. No one knows how to do anything, at least no one with power. No one is making decisions. No one is thinking this through. And that's when I realized we're on our own. We have a failed state. We cannot count on our government to do the first thing here. It's still a shock. Still a shock.
We learned so many things in a pandemic. We're learning, for example, that we have two kinds of work in this country, essential work, meaning dangerous and low-paid work, and then non-essential work. In a smartphone economy, you write, we hide whole classes of human beings. We're learning where our food and goods come from, who keeps us alive. An order of baby arugula on Amazon Fresh is cheap and arrives overnight in part because the people who grow it, sort it, pack it, deliver it, have to keep working while they're sick. For most service workers, sick leave turns out to be an impossible luxury. We're learning a whole lot about the incredibly unequal structures of our work.
Yeah, we should know that because that's been the nature of our economy more and more so for years. It's just that it's now hidden from us because we don't have to go to the store. We get packages delivered while we're out of the house. Everything can be done with a press of an app. It's frictionless, as they say in Silicon Valley. But what that means is we don't see the human cost. We are allowed to forget the human cost if we don't want to think about it. Now we have to think about it because we're thinking about who's been touching that package and who's been touching that food.
George, I go through your article noticing so many things that, of course, I was aware of, but I didn't protest at the time. For example, Sarah Palin as a nominee for vice president. I said at the time to myself, that's American fascism at work because it's a joke. Jared Kushner is another one, and you make much of it. Here's a guy whose father bought his way into Harvard for $2.5 million, thoroughly mediocre career, and he's at the right hand of God in our government. We had so many warnings.
We did. Well, the truth is Trump has pretty much been as good as his word. I mean, there was nothing hidden about him or his plans in the 2016 campaign. It was all out there. We don't want brown people. We don't want Muslims. We don't want foreigners. NATO is optional. We don't want to care about people who don't look like us. It was there for us to see. Fascism usually is. It's not subtle. In fact, it's powerful by being unsubtle and repetitive and blatant. You're right that the American version is more of a joke and more, it's certainly more incompetent. Trump came into office at war with his own bureaucracy. His first big move was to fire his FBI director for being honest. That was a sign that this was a man who was going to bend the government until it broke and became a tool for his own personal interest, which is what it is now, which is why we don't hear from the CDC anymore throughout this pandemic. He shut them down because they weren't saying things that were useful to him. All of that was clear. He got away with it for 3 years because we never had a crisis like this. He had a relatively quiet time to be president until now. But as soon as something on this scale happened, it was so obvious that, yeah, of course, we saw it coming or should have seen it coming.
It's not as if he weren't under heavy attack all through his administration. Why has it been so ineffective? Why did it not dawn on a lot of people, including the likes of me, that he's after your country? That was sort of Tim Snyder's line in On Tyranny. What he's after is the essential self-reliant, social, respectful, quasi-egalitarian spirit of American public life. And you never supposed that he could be so bold or get away with it.
Well, he hasn't completely gotten away with it. I mean, one thing to not forget is that every election since the election he won has been a defeat for him. The midterms were a defeat for him. Every off-year gubernatorial race has been a defeat for him. You can't fool all the people all the time. There is a solid minority that is never going to change their minds about Trump, and they may be enough to keep him in office in November, but it is by no means certain, and there's absolutely nothing that says we are on a downward trajectory that can never be reversed.
I want you to come to your non-despairing observation toward the end of your piece, George. You say the fight to overcome the pandemic must also be a fight to recover the health of our country and build it anew, or the hardship and grief we're now enduring will never be redeemed and nothing will be changed. Let's talk about do-overs, drawing lines of decency, of reasonable policy, for example. Where would you begin?
The tax cut was a monumental folly, partly because it sent money to people who didn't need it, who'd been making a lot of it over the previous decade. And it also left us in a hole when we should have been preparing for a storm like what we're seeing now. And the general idea that we can dispense with our public obligations and our public space, that it doesn't matter if we let it decay. It doesn't matter if the language of contempt for government, for people who work in government, for public institutions, that won't really ever come back to bite us. Well, it's biting us now, really biting us. And not just in New York City and Washington, it's biting us in small towns and rural areas that have defunded their own healthcare system. And so when the pandemic hits them, they'll have even less to fall back on. That's where I would start. I would also talk about workers and what rights they should have. I mean, the decline of unions and the decline of workers' rights has led directly to sickness and death. And this is hard political work, the work of organizing, the work of elections, the work of losing and coming back and trying again. I think the left and liberals need to be every bit as tenacious and unrelenting as the right has been over the last few decades in not giving up on the issues that matter just because you lose one round.
George Packer's last book and his last long conversation on open source was about his friend Richard Holbrook and the end of the American century. Our Man, as he titled that biography. Coming up, what you haven't been hearing from the near nominee for president, Joe Biden, and what you might rather not hear about him. This is Open Source. Joseph R. Biden, Delaware Democrat, former vice president, is on an awkward spot that's all his own in this pandemic. He was anointed the moderate alternative when Bernie Sanders rallied up the left in the early Democratic primaries, but then Biden was dubbed the presumptive nominee when the coronavirus shut down all campaigning in March. Joe Biden had nearly swept the Super Tuesday primaries, though he did lose the big one, California. So he wasn't quite finally tested for the nomination, and now he waits the critical test of his life. It's a situation that the writer Nathan Robinson finds deliciously dangerous.
The hashtag Where is Joe was trending for a while because there were ever more implausible excuses for Joe Biden's lack of appearances on television during critical weeks where the coronavirus was escalating in its severity, and he wasn't even heard from at all beyond a thumbs up post on Instagram. It was just an emoji. Right, and they pointed to the emoji as evidence that he was still living. But even though he's built a studio in his home basement and he goes on television pretty regularly now, actually, as you can tell from the clips of gaffes that emerge every few days, I don't believe he's doing, but he said he was going to do a daily response to Trump's press conferences and promised that he'd become more visible. But aside from a number of interviews, which most people agree have gone either okay to not very well at all, Joe Biden has not been heard much from. Now, I think separate from the speculation on Joe Biden's fitness is I think the fact that there is no coherent message for Joe Biden to utter. Because, in fact, he's been quoted as saying he didn't want to be too political in his response to Donald Trump. And I think Joe Biden, because he subscribes very, very strongly and deeply to the kind of ideology of civility, right, where the idea of criticizing a sitting president in a crisis too harshly is something that he's uncomfortable with doing, but also the central fact that an opposition leader needs to be pointing out right now is the colossal mismanagement and failure of leadership coming out of the Trump administration. So I think one reason for Joe Biden's silence would be, in part, they don't really know what to have Joe Biden say other than offering some sort of cliches about, we'll get through this, we need more testing, where do you go from there?
Joe Biden is the missing person at this pandemic roundtable, and it's still hard to explain. The campaign ended before it was over, not long after Super Tuesday. It just snapped shut. The label presumptive nominee was slapped on him, but it's astonishing that a presidential nominee, favorite, is so weirdly silent. Does he have nothing to say, do you think? Would he rather not be in the fray?
I think Joe Biden has had a reputation for decades as a gaffe machine, and everyone understands that every moment that Joe Biden is exposed to the light of publicity that he gives an interview is a risk. So in order to run against Trump, the best to keep it as low risk as possible, that is to say as little as possible, and have the image of Joe Biden be what's really running for president.
Nathan Robinson, you call him wrong on the issues, but also unelectable. And we got to put emphasis on both of those points before it's too late. What's wrong with his record? Besides corporate America, the war in Iraq, the crime bill, a few other things like that.
Yeah, people know about the war in Iraq. They know about his role. Although the crime bill, it's worth emphasizing that throughout the 80s, Biden was a real tough-on-crime Democrat who tried to push the party to the right on crime. If you look at clips of him calling for the execution of drug dealers, you know, shutting down and demolishing raves, he was really at the forefront of bringing Democrats towards Reagan-esque Republican tough-on-crime talking points. And that's the problem with Joe Biden's record, is that throughout all of his years in the Senate, he bragged about being one of the most conservative Democratic senators. And so it was things like opposing busing measures for school integration. It was things like on abortion, saying he didn't think that abortion was a right. It was things like writing the first version of the Patriot Act, which he was proud of. So all of those kinds of things that those of us who are progressives have been so frustrated in the Democratic Party, Biden was complicit in making the party about those things.
He said things going back over the years that he might be just too muscular on foreign policy, not pure enough on abortion rights, not energetic enough on gay marriage, things like that, not quite apologetically. How did he get away with it in those endless debates among the Democratic candidates?
Well, you know, one way he got away with it is sort of by disappearing, by fading into the background. In fact, there's something almost brilliant about the fact that Joe Biden was doing so poorly for so long, because it meant he sort of escaped scrutiny. And so after Joe Biden flopped in Iowa, then flopped again in New Hampshire, people really kind of stopped paying attention to Joe Biden. There wasn't the kind of forceful criticism of him at the debates that you would expect if he had been the front runner all through the debates, because you attack the front runner. And everyone kind of took turns as the front runner, so they took turns taking the fire, but not him.
Yet so many people, and I know a number of them, think Joe Biden's a kind of good guy. He's been around forever, knows everybody. Barack Obama not only chose him, but endorses him enthusiastically. Regular guy. Why do you call him, and spell it out, unelectable?
Well, I would dispute that Barack Obama enthusiastically endorses him, because, as we know, Barack Obama didn't endorse him until he was the last remaining candidate, and in fact rather infamously tried to discourage him from running. So but when we talk about electability, right, who's the best candidate to run against Trump? We have to think about Donald Trump. And what Democrats often don't understand is that Donald Trump is a really formidable politician. And he's very good at exposing the hypocrisy and the weakness of the Democratic Party. So he runs to the left. He did that to Hillary Clinton, going after her as a Wall Street candidate, a pro-war candidate. And it's effective because on the points that he goes after them on, he's right. And now he's already started criticizing Biden over criminal justice. He's done ads promoting his record as a criminal justice reformer. Why? Because he knows that he's right on those points and that Biden is having to defend the wrong side.
We're reenacting an important piece of history in my memory here, Nathan Robinson, and that was 4 years ago when your inaugural issue of the magazine Current Affairs declared that Hillary Clinton was the one candidate that Donald Trump would defeat. Not only that, you wrote a text of the first debate between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, and it was positively shocking.
the degree to which you anticipated reality. You called that not only Hillary's weakness, but Trump's extraordinary, indefinable power. In what sense are we repeating that history?
I think that Democrats are running pretty much the same electability playbook that they did in 2016. They have convinced the public of the same arguments, which is that Bernie Sanders' brand of radical leftism is unpalatable and too much of a risk, and that the safe choice is to have a Democratic centrist who isn't trying to fundamentally change anything. You know, Joe Biden, direct quote, "Nothing will fundamentally change if I'm elected." You know, that lack of that sense of stability, that's what people want, and that's what you want to run. And that's very powerful, actually, because people don't want to take risks. I just think that it's backwards. I thought that it was backwards in 2016. I think that it's backwards now, because "nothing will fundamentally change" inspires nobody. And if you want to be president, you have to inspire people.
What did the Democrats not learn in 2016 in the defeat of Hillary Clinton?
Well, what they didn't learn was that the whole theory of electability is seriously flawed. And a very clear example of this, right, is throughout the entire primary, the dispute between Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, and between Bernie Sanders and everyone else, was over employer-based health insurance versus single-payer health insurance. And now we're in a crisis in which the fact that health insurance is employer-based is causing a massive crisis. It's something you can run on if you're a candidate who is against the system of employer-based insurance. But if you're a candidate who has just spent the entire primary defending the system of employer-based insurance, how on earth are you going to inspire people with your healthcare policy in a time where the issue is the very collapse of a system that you have invested so much in?
Nathan, you virtually wrote the Donald Trump debate attack on Hillary Clinton months before it happened. Have you scripted Donald Trump's debate against Joe Biden yet?
Well, I think we know what Donald Trump is going to do, which is he's going to paint Joe Biden as an out-of-touch member of the establishment who has spent his life pushing unpopular policies, and he's also going to push the corruption stuff. And we can sort of script that in Donald Trump's unique language. The Biden side of it is less clear, because Joe Biden has actually been – he's actually very hit and miss. And if you notice him at the last debate with Bernie Sanders, he was actually quite good. He was actually really on form. And so there's a big open question, which is, are we going to see the Biden that struggles to complete a sentence and that Donald Trump will just run rings around and it'll just be this horrible embarrassment? Or is Biden going to summon some fire deep within him and actually give Donald Trump a good reply? So I actually think I really can't imagine these debates at this point. It's such a strange thing to try to picture.
There is a bit of a coherence thing now and then. There's also a health question, but there's also a just plain vitality question around Joe. It comes and goes. What's your measure of that in a knockdown, drag-out campaign?
I mean, the fact that Joe Biden has, over the course of this campaign, done fairly few public events, the fact that they have tried to keep his appearances to a minimum, is very, very troubling, because we know that, I mean, we don't know how coronavirus is going to affect the ability of Donald Trump to hold rallies, but we know that Donald Trump's strategy is going to be involved being very, very visible to his voters, really just swamping the airwaves with his presence by constantly saying controversial things that then make people angry, then they cover him. And, you know, he'll do tons of rallies, he'll do 100 rallies if he can. Donald Trump really is a man of boundless energy. And I feel like you need a lot of energy to counter that. And I think almost nobody senses that in Joe Biden. And when Donald Trump calls him Sleepy Joe, it resonates with people for a reason.
Nathan, nobody sees Joe Biden, even the ones who love him, as a strong candidate at the top of his form. Why is he so, universal consensus, the candidate of the party still? It doesn't take the wildest imagination to suppose that he will be switched out at some point later in the summer for a stronger candidate. It could be Andrew Cuomo. It could be Jay Inslee. It could be Gavin Newsom. But are we looking at the real nominee here?
It's difficult to say. I mean, switching out the nominee at the convention, I don't think it's happened before, although conventions obviously used to work very differently. There's talk about, well, how would that happen? And because Biden himself would have to step down, the delegates are committed to him. But that's not unforeseeable. I mean, pressure could be put on Biden within the party by Barack Obama, the same way Barack Obama pressured others to drop out.
Right.
The Democratic Party could say, look, Joe, you're stepping aside for health reasons. We've prepared your statement and you just need to sign it. So I think there are a lot of people who are right now trying to think about how something like that could be engineered, because they're not completely foolish. They do see the risks of running Joe Biden, and they do see that there are other Democrats who are more electable, even by their standards of electability, which involve, you know, at least some charisma and energy.
For example, who are you thinking of who would be more formidable?
I mean, it's hard to say, really, because, like, I don't really know how a race between Gavin Newsom and Donald Trump would pan out, or Andrew Cuomo and Donald Trump would go. And Andrew Cuomo has the kind of record that Biden has, so he's susceptible to a lot of the same criticisms from Donald Trump that Biden has, Gavin Newsom slightly less so. I don't really know how these candidates would do against Donald Trump. My sense is probably the switching out itself would cast such a cloud over the entire election, because it had just upended the popular vote of the people and made the process completely undemocratic, that it would really make it much easier for Trump to win if the entire primary turned out to be pointless because there was a last minute switch by insider elites. I feel like that would set them up for a loss.
Nathan, I'm predisposed to listen carefully to you because of 4 years ago. I simply marvel that run-of-the-mill Democrats don't say, wait a sec, we've seen this movie before, and it ends with the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, one reason they don't is because in order for them to accept that, they would have to accept that a lot of their worldview is wrong, their fundamental core worldview.
Well, they've had the news handed to them in the election returns of 4 years ago, no?
And some people learn, but I think it is extremely hard when something is the way that you view it. It's not just like I was wrong about this candidate, but I was fundamentally wrong about where this party should be going, what it should stand for, what the core issues are. That is a really hard transition. And so that's why you see people doubling down and doing the same. I mean, they'll be doing the same and probably do the same thing in 2024, even if Biden gets crushed. Right. I wouldn't doubt it. I don't think there's going to be an, oh, all of a sudden now we need to embrace democratic socialism. I don't think you're ever going to see that. They could lose 10 elections in a row and the strategy is not going to change.
Nathan, what's going to revive this campaign? I'm still struck, as when we began, that there's a silence here, a spooky, eerie non-verbalization of this campaign. Oh. Cuomo up in New York doing his thing every day, Trump in Washington, Joe Biden in his basement somewhere, and who knows what he's thinking?
Yeah, I don't know if the campaign is going to be revived. I mean, there's a lot of months till the general election. At some point, I assume this will change. If we're still on lockdowns and Joe Biden still hasn't left his basement and is just sort of a head in his library occasionally popping onto your TV screens, it seems like Donald Trump would win in a landslide. On the other hand, if Joe Biden is just a name on a ballot and a spooky, eerie non-presence, but we're in a depression and hundreds of thousands of people have died because of Trump's actions, people might want to vote for just whatever the other name on the ballot is. So a lot depends on how bad things get and how bad Trump messes things up in the next months.
Mm. Nathan Robinson, you'll do for a prognosticator on my team. It was a remarkable thing you pulled off 4 years ago. Let's see. And we'll talk with you again before it's over.
I hope so. All right. Thanks, Chris. Nice to be with you.
Nathan Robinson edits his current affairs from New Orleans on slick paper and online. He calls it a magazine of culture, politics, and the absurd. Thank you, Nathan Robinson, and George Packer, and Michael Greenberg. We hope you listeners will think of supporting open source and the hardest working team in radio. The best way is to join our Patreon community at patreon.com/radioopensource, where you can hear producer Adam Coleman's series of conversations on storytelling in a time of social distancing. This week, Adam talks to Harty White, the surreal radio monologuist, about what radio does in a time of social isolation. Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our first responder. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time. Join us every time on Open Source.
Hub
and Spoke.
Audio Collective.